The seat, well, I know it's been nearly a year since I've been here. I've become a grandad yet again. The seat does not indicate I'm decaying totally. It's just for the past 3 months I've had a trapped sciatic nerve. And as we were singing that last hymn, I thought on the chorus was very timely, because have I not a seat? And I get into a sort of a way of thinking, and when I'm preaching, I move too fast. Those lines come true. I will fall at your feet. So I'm better stabilised in one place. It's lovely. It's lovely to be here, just to enter the joy of our own family expanding. And it's a lovely thought. Yonatan, Jonathan, literally, the Lord has given. And then to hear of the expansion, really, of your own family here in Bellevue, because in a sense we feel members at a distance. So it's lovely to hear of your plans and your growth. Exciting to hear what God is doing in Edinburgh. And it was on a visit to Edinburgh just about 4 years ago when David Match, who was born in Scotland but now has his artist studio in London, was putting on an exhibition at the invitation of the Edinburgh Council. They invited David Match to celebrate Precious Light, 400 years of the King James Version. And in the Edinburgh Arts Centre, he put on this phenomenal exhibition of huge collages. This is one of them. If you got to see a studio which had been on the third floor, it was just hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of really literally shirt boxes. Because the man goes through magazines and journals, cuts out pictures of, say, trees, of animals, of various faces, collects them, systematizes them. Then when he creates these huge collages, which are about double the size of that screen, many of them even much bigger, they are built up of all these little pieces. And what very much struck me as I looked at these collages celebrating the text of the King James Version was, well, you can see here, this was his picture of the days of Noah, set against the background of Arthur's Seat and the city of Edinburgh. And when you begin to look, now these are pictures, you've got to go away. Look up David Match, M-A-C-H-S, online. Because these are not pictures you just, you've got to look at them, be drawn into them. And you see, they just draw you in. Now remember, these are built up, just layer by layer by layer. And what's very striking, this is his version of Babel. And when you look at Babel, on one level it looks so normal. It's about the whole human enterprise. It's about man's city-building activity. And as you look at his version of Babel, and you look at the people going about their business, do you know what reminded me in a very, very, very ancient rabbinic story that said that Babel was so big, probably was in the ancient world what we call a ziggurat, it was so big that the stairs up one side took 1 year to get up to the top, and it took 1 year to get down on the other side. When a brick fell from the top, they all lamented, "Oh, we have lost a brick." When a baby was born, the mother worked on, dropped the child, then worked on. There was more fuss over a lost brick, because it took a year to replace a brick, than there was over life. And you get to think, isn't that an absurdly exaggerated story until you look at modern suburbia? Life in a modern society that puts such excruciating pressures on people, that work turns people into workaholics, where they don't have time for families, and where material things, even things like bricks, become more precious than life itself. See, what I love about David Match, and I had the good fortune to actually meet him, he was there that afternoon we were there, and I happened to say to him as I browsed these, and I didn't mean this to shock anybody, but I actually said to him, do you know, You may be claiming to come at this from a completely secular point of view, but you are actually, to my mind, communicating the Bible much more clearly than many preachers I've ever heard. Because many preachers are like, well, my father used to call them bumblebees and syrup tins. They just bzzz, bzzz. They're so monotonous, so monochromatic. Here he's putting a full visual picture before us of a situation that, when he used Edinburgh as the background, challenged me to think, here's the ancient text against the background and in the context of the modern city. And that's precisely what you're going to do over the next few weeks, as believe me, you will get excited about Leviticus. It is astounding. It's a wonderful book. But you see, David Match helped me to go back, look at the relationship. And this is exactly what we're wrestling with today. How do I relate this very, very ancient text to life in a modern city, in a modern society? That's a real challenge. Because a lot of us struggle, particularly with what we call the Old Testament. Now, I'm not trying to be pedantic, nor kind of fussy here, but I have tried to discipline myself never now to talk about the Old Testament. For the simple reason, it was the only Bible Jesus had. And I don't believe Jesus would ever have called it the Old Testament. These were his scriptures. I like to think of them as the Hebrew Bible, the Jewish scriptures. Because these are his texts. And probably as a boy, along with many other Jewish boys in the Galilee of the first century, in Jewish tradition, he would have, by the time he was in his mid-teens, have memorized the entire Torah, the first five books of the Bible. And that's what we want to explore a little bit by way of introduction. The Bible as Jesus knew it. And in many ways, you know, even to sit to teach, you often read, Jesus sat to teach. You find that was a rabbinic model. And they would sit to teach what was fundamentally the Torah. Now, bear this in mind. This is going to, this morning, require a little bit of sort of mental change. Because we have this sort of attitude, oh, we're Christians. We somehow or other have moved beyond this Old Testament. When we think of them as the Hebrew Scriptures, the Jewish Bible, and see them as the only Bible that Jesus had. Remember this. Jesus had no New Testament. Jesus never read a New Testament. Jesus never was in a church. Jesus never sat in a pew. Jesus never spoke English. How many Western Christians think Jesus parachuted in as a Western Protestant to the Reformation? They cannot cope with him as a Torah observant, synagogue attending, Jewish villager who took time to learn a trade, enter into the fabric of life of a community, learn the scriptures, be marinated with them. So bear this in mind. Because as we relate this ancient text to the modern world, well, I'm suggesting to you one of our models for doing this is Jesus himself. Because isn't it profoundly striking that the first text to which the risen Jesus turned was the text of the Hebrew Bible. Raised from the dead, his first activity, well, if you sort of want it in modern theological academic terminology, his first task was a hermeneutical task. Hermeneutics is, no, it's not like many of my kind of former dyslexic students thought was a relation to Hermann Monster. Hermeneutics is the technical study of the text, the principles involved in drawing out the meaning from the text. And that's exactly what Jesus did. Because what do we read? Beginning with Moses, which is the Jewish way of talking about Torah, and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. Now, I'd love to have been in that class. And I know myself, I am eminently well qualified to have been in that class. Because Jesus said to these members of that first class on the Emmaus Road, You're thick. You've been studying this all these years and you still haven't got it. Now, the English is very delicate and quite polite, but the bottom line is, boys, you are a few sandwiches short of the proverbial picnic. The lights may be on, but nobody's in. You are not knowing how to handle the text. And so he begins with Moses. Isn't this striking? Raised from the dead, about to be glorified, and he begins that period just between his resurrection and ascension by teaching them from the scriptures. And particularly that first, imagine, through the entire Hebrew Bible in 7 miles between Emmaus and Jerusalem. And then if you missed it the first time, look down chapter 24 to verse 44. And then he says, everything written about me in the law of Moses, that's the Torah, the prophets and the Psalms, these things must be fulfilled. So I think it's very useful for us to begin to say, what was Jesus' attitude towards what we call the Old Testament? What was Jesus' attitude towards what we have between Genesis and Malachi? Well, that's where we get, you see, the insight. And Luke gives us the clue, beginning with the Torah, Moses, the prophets, and Luke says, the Psalms. Now, if you went into a Jewish bookshop and asked for a Bible, what you would get would what's called a Tanakh. T-N-K, Tanakh. Because that reflects Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim. These words are, well, they reflect the three words that actually Luke uses here. The law of Moses, that's the Torah. The prophets, the Nevi'im, and the... Now, the third section is made up of books like Psalms and Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, and the biggest part of that third section called the wisdom literature is the Psalms. So in some Bibles it's called the writings, but in Jewish tradition it was often, as Luke does, refer to it as the Psalms. So what, now you grasp this now, what Jesus did on the Emmaus Road was a programmatic, systematic, conducted tour through the entire Hebrew Bible in 7 miles. And he taught about how he had come, do you notice the last phrase, to fulfill the law. Let's try to get rid of that word law for a minute. It has its place, but its law is only part of this story. You see, we're looking now at what's called an idiom. Jesus and his contemporaries would all have been familiar with an idiom, fulfill the Torah. This was common in Hebrew language. I know you might be saying, oh, but listen, the New Testament written in Greek. Yes, it was written in Greek, but it was written in Greek by Hebrew thinkers, by Jewish minds. And you find that there's currently, even in Jerusalem, work going on, what's called back translation, to show how easily the Greek text falls back into Hebrew. And in falling back into Hebrew, then you discover we have access to some of the idioms, some of the figurative kind of metaphorical language that otherwise was difficult to understand a little bit in Greek and almost inaccessible to us then in English. But actually that phrase, fulfill the Torah, is an idiom. It was quite common in the rabbinic world of the day. And that's why when you're reading, you see, the Torah, immediately we've got to dispel any notion that this is simply a collection of rules and regulations that somehow or another God as a big policeman imposed on Israel and downloaded on a people at an unsuspecting moment. We're going to try today to sort of savor a totally different mindset as we approach these opening books of the Bible. To, in a sense, look at some of what we might call mental traditional roots that are well worn. And we're going to re-root our thinking. And we're going to ask, well, how would a first century mind have approached this text? Well, you see the word Torah every word in Hebrew comes from a verb. When you look at family trees, the great, 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 great grandparents of the word Torah was a verb, yara. And yara meant to fire an arrow. And an arrow, well, when you fired it, you gave it direction. You put it on target. Incidentally, when you take a child's life and you put them on target, when you want to teach them, you discover in Israel today, a modern classroom teacher is called a mora, who brings her Torah. In Proverbs chapter 1, my son, I want you to listen to the Torah of your mother. Mothers want their sons to be on target. Mothers want their children to get the right goals. And that's the idea. Torah. Torah is not a policeman sitting up there in heaven imposing legislation, but a loving parent saying, in a dark world, in a world that is so misguided and deluded, I want to choose a people. Now, albeit they will turn out to be quite intransigent and stubborn at times, but I'm going to choose the Jewish people that I might put them in the right direction and to give them the curriculum for living. So you see, Torah is about putting life on target, not law. When I think of law, oh, law has a very, very vivid image. I can see it right before my eyes now. It's got a freckled face. It's got a police uniform because it's just stepped out in front of me. I was doing 49 miles an hour in a 30-mile zone. I said, look, I was in a queue of traffic. Yes, sir, you were, but you were the only one still accelerating. Law is there to get you when you've done wrong. And then we see, we take that and we impose that on the Bible. Right? Law, this is all about the big judge sitting there just waiting till you get off the tightrope. And then I'll bring judgment. We'll talk a little bit about that approach to the Bible tonight. But you see, no, it's from the beginning God saying, I want to give you teaching, I want to give you direction. And listen, I'm going to send somebody to help you interpret it. So that's why it's important for us to know how Jesus approached the Torah. And we've got access to it. This is the striking thing. Because Jesus said, think not, Matthew's gospel, think not I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have come not to abolish them, but to fulfill them. Now, let's look at that phrase. You see where Jesus says, think not that I have come. By the way, this is where you need big ears. The bigger the ears you have, the better. And if you can take a hint, you know what, you said that, get it right in the ribs. You can't read the New Testament, you can't listen to Jesus unless you have big ears that pick up all the allusions, the hints, the evocations, the associations with what's gone before. Oh, kind of technically, in academic circles today, they call it intertextuality. Whew, that's a big word. The bottom line is, big ears, listen. And time after time, you're going to hear Jesus using language that is either directly taken out of the Hebrew Bible or directly from the first century kind of world of the rabbis, the teachers. And you see this little phrase, I have come. We generally read it in the West, I have come. Oh, well, immediately we think, oh, Christmas time. Incarnation. Jesus has come to earth. That's there. Can't deny that. But you know, in Edinburgh, he's a wee bit dated now, but I think he's one of the great thinkers of recent history. You know Jimmy Cricket? Because no matter when you read a biblical text, you always, and there's more. And there's more. I have come. Yes, he did come, incarnate. We were singing about that earlier on. But in rabbinic thought of the first century, I have come is actually a statement of intention. This would have been used by the rabbis of Jesus' day. And in the world of the rabbinic world, intention is very, very important. Jesus highlights that when he said, do you remember the, what seems to be a foolish question to us? Why do you light that lamp? That's actually a fundamental question of intention, because Jesus is saying, are you lighting it so that you'll put it out when it becomes inconvenient? Or will you let it shine even when it demands some sacrifice on your part? So this is his intention. And what's his intention? I have come. Don't think I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I have not come to abolish, but to fill. Now again, when we listen, we discover these are actually technical terms that have now come to light from studies in the first century rabbinic world. And we discover that when you back translate into Hebrew, when Jesus says, I have come not to abolish the Torah, he's saying, I've come not to misrepresent it. I have come not to mishandle it. I have come not to misinterpret it. And I have come to fulfill it. I have come to correctly interpret it. Because these were common phrases in the first century Jewish world. So Jesus is talking the language of his people in this day and saying, listen, don't you be afraid. I have not come to mishandle this. You can trust my interpretation. I have come to cram it full, to bring it to full expression, to show the rich, the full, the original intended meaning that God had for it. This is Jesus' approach to it. Jesus doesn't begin Matthew's gospel and say, oh, now that I'm raised from the dead, basically you can forget about everything before the blank page in the Bible. No. He is systematically, programmatically saying, this is written about me. It is preparatory. It is ready for me coming. And look at how he draws out from this teaching. We don't have time now, obviously. But go on to look at what is called the rest of the Sermon on the Mount, which follows these statements of his intention, where he draws out from the Torah teaching about murder, about anger, about adultery, the major themes of the Sermon on the Mount. By the way, and a lot of Christians do not appreciate this, so many Jewish people could read the Sermon on the Mount and say a hearty amen to it. Why? Because Yeshua, Jesus, is drawing out the essential teaching of God to put a society on target with relationships, with anger, with marriage, with raising children, with friendships, with work. Jesus takes these disciples back to the foundational document, to the Torah itself. See, in a sense, if you were to put it into modern English, what Jesus says, my intent is not to weaken or negate the Torah, the teaching, the direction that God has given, but by properly interpreting God's written word, I aim to establish it, to even make it more lasting. This is what Jesus says. I'd never invalidate it by removing something from it through misinterpretation. Never imagine for a moment that I intend to abrogate it or misrepresent it. Jesus had grown up in the synagogue. He had been marinated by this text. He would show respect to it. He says, you know, heaven and earth will sooner disappear than something from the Torah. This is sort of the modernization of what Jesus said in Matthew. He says, not even the smallest letter of the alphabet, little yod. Yod's tiny. Yod's a little diminutive. Oh, yod, probably if you look at your text, if it's open before you now, yod's like a little comma. A comma is the closest thing in English you'll get to a yod in Hebrew. And Jesus says, not even the tiniest little yod, but not only a yod. Look, do you see the little yod here? And do you see above the curved bit, there's just a little bit of a head sticking up. That's called a little crown. Jittle. Sometimes it's got three little points on it. But Jesus' point says, not even a jot, Not even a little yod. And listen, not even the tiniest little decorative crown that those wonderful calligraphers, the scribes, put on them. Not even that little crown will ever disappear. Do you see the integrity Jesus gives to the text? You know, I know, listen, I'm into my 60s now, and in some ways, technologically, I'm a bit of a Luddite. But I can text. And it often strikes me, you know, here's your original text message. God committed himself to text. We were thinking about the integrity and the power of words in the earlier communion service this morning. See, word in Hebrew not only means the spoken thing, word also means something substantial, a thing as well. So here God has given us the original text message. And of course, the early parts of that text, well, you're going to study in detail when you come to look at the book of Leviticus. But the earliest part was the Torah. Come with me. I wish we could go this morning. Just down to what's called the Kotel Plaza. It's the Western Wall Plaza. Probably one of the most... I doubt if there's anybody here hasn't got a friend who sent them a postcard from Jerusalem. And they've always had... Now, we call it the Western Wall. They don't today. They call it the Wall or the Kotel. The Western... The Wailing Wall has not been called the Wailing Wall since for quite a number of years now. So it's called the Western Wall. Now, when you go there today, particularly on a Monday morning or a Thursday morning, oh, it's like Northern Ireland on the 12th of July. I'm sorry if you've never been, but I know there are enough of you here with links with Northern Ireland. You hear music coming at you from everywhere. And you go up in the old city, all the little streets, it's the wall is like a major heart in the heart of the old city, and all the little narrow alleyways and streets, they're like arteries, pumping their way, pumping people to the wall. And then you'll hear the drums or you'll hear the shofar blowing, and you go up and you'll see a family coming down, and you'll see a chuppah, a covering. There's a little boy under it. The family are all whooping and dancing all around, and maybe something will hit you in the back of the head, and you look and say, what's a sweetie? Because his aunts, his grannies, they just bring bags of sweets or candies and throw them at people. They're rejoicing. They're celebrating. They're obviously kind of privileged families, because on a Monday and a Thursday, they're having their bar mitzvah, becoming sons of the commandment, becoming sons of the Torah at the wall. And there is joy as they proceed down to the wall, and the boy takes the Torah scrolls and on his birthday reads the passage from the Torah that would normally be read on the Shabbat, on the Sabbath, nearest to his birthday. And the celebration and the joy. Boy, you know, for me as a kind of a Northern Ireland Presbyterian, it's the very antithesis of a Sunday morning. It's filled with laughter, with joy, vitality. It's vibrant, it's warm. And they're celebrating Torah. They're celebrating their child, their son, has taken the yoke of Torah. He has become... That's, by the way, when Jesus says, take my yoke upon you, he's saying, come, study with me. Take my yoke and learn of me. And fundamental to all his teaching is the Torah. So you think of this Torah not as some dry, dead, heavy-handed, sort of pettifogging legalism, not some dry, paralyzing fundamentalism that zaps you of spiritual life and puts you on a legalistic tightrope, but a life-giving, life-directing source that comes from God. No wonder they sing, how I love your Torah. Can you imagine? Maybe if you have a little while tonight, this afternoon or tonight, ask Jesus and just do this. Maybe open your Bible. You don't have to go beyond actually the opening pages. But just ask Jesus, Take me on a mental Emmaus road through the text. Can you imagine Jesus as the teacher going with you through the text? When he begins Genesis, he begins to tell you, well, you can read about this in Hebrews 1 and John 1 and Colossians 1 as well. Don't you know I was there at the very beginning, the Word through whom all things were made? You get to Genesis 12, don't you realize he can say, you know, it is in me, those promises to Abraham are fulfilled. Come to Exodus and discover that he's telling you, I'm a greater than Moses. I am the ultimate freedom giver. I can lead you through from any bondage to give you life and to give you freedom. Come with me through the book of Leviticus and meet the ultimate high priest, the ultimate mediator between heaven and the earth, the ultimate expression and incarnation of holiness. See in me what God is really like. And come with me, I'll take you on the ultimate journey as I led the people through the wilderness in the book of Numbers. I'm still leading people who are on the way, who are on a journey towards the fulfillment of the promise. I want to lead you into the intimacy of covenant. We can explore an old covenant in Deuteronomy. I can take you into an even richer, fuller, and more vibrant new covenant that's to come later on, but that never abrogates what God has taught in Deuteronomy. Oh, and let's not stop with Torah, because I can take you on. I can take you into Joshua, because Jesus really is a variant of Joshua. I'm the ultimate rest giver and the ultimate one who leads you to victory. And you think you're living in difficult days of not just immorality, but veritable amorality? Come with me into the days of the judges, when everybody thought there was no king in the land, so they could just do whatever the devil they wanted. Come with me into days where I will show you the nature of true charismatic leadership. I will truly show you what it means to be anointed with God and to cope in difficult days. Or come with me through those difficult days of monarchy when you had a society longing for leadership and often getting failed leadership in figures like Saul and then figures like David. And ultimately Jesus saying, don't you know, God in his grace is preparing you for a greater son of David who will come. Can you travel with him? Can you travel with Jesus through books like Job and sit and say, you know, I'm the eminently well-qualified one to talk about why innocent people suffer. Come through the Psalms with him and discover the ups and the downs, the joys and desolation of everyday life. Come with them through Proverbs, because he was in wisdom incarnate. Come through the Song of Solomon with him and find one who can unashamedly and unembarrassedly talk about sex in the context of God-given marriage and the joy of that intimacy and mutuality. Come with him through Ecclesiastes and explore the real meaning of life. And come through every one of those prophets and hear not a message that's to be supplemented by Mary Baker Eddy or Joseph Smith or any other sect, but hear the final word. Extend Emmaus. Take it into the fabric of everyday life. For as he travels with us and as he teaches us from these Hebrew Bibles, like these people in the Emmaus Road, may our hearts burn within us. And if we started off walking, may we find ourselves running. How I love your Torah. It's sweeter than honey. It's more precious than any other teaching or guidance I could ever have. Let's pray. Lord, it would have been lovely to be with you on that day on the Emmaus Road. But we still have the curriculum. We still have the text, and now we have your Spirit with us. May that Spirit reverberate with life and help us to meet the living Word as we explore together the written Word. And may we in our hearts rejoice in loving your teaching, in rejoicing in it. For what more precious thing could we have than your word? Through Jesus we pray. Amen.